Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. A couple of weeks ago, I was wandering around in some old crumbling buildings in a former state institution called Pennhurst. People with intellectual disabilities used to live here. It's about an hour from Philadelphia. It closed down in the 80s and it was abandoned for almost 20 years.
The roof is no good, huh?
Well, most of the roofs are no good. We have to make sure we stop the water from getting in.
Jim Werner is the new operations manager here. They're trying to restore some of these buildings. He's known this place for years, and he told me it was as if people just locked the doors and walked away.
I mean, there was chairs, tables, beds, bureaus, papers, just like, quite honestly, like the buildings were just left.
I also met Donna Samlick. She used to work here in the 70s and 80s when hundreds of people were living here. She was an aide. When she returned years after the last building had closed its doors, she was shocked.
Well, the first time I came here, I remember thinking, oh my God, what happened? But I hadn't been here since it closed. And I remember the manicured lawns, the freshly painted walls, the, you know, waxed floors. And when I came in and saw it in such disrepair, and Mother Nature really took over. You know, and to see it all overgrown like that, it was like, wow, what happened?
Weeds growing in buildings, rain pouring in through leaky roofs, structures decomposing into the earth. Nature has reclaimed much of this space. When we abandon things, something else comes in to fill the void. And that's what we're exploring on today's episode. What happens to all that we leave behind? The places, the people, the stuff? Let's start with a story about nature having a harder time taking back land that humans have altered. In the U.S., there are as many as 500,000 abandoned mines. Many of them are coal mines in states like West Virginia, Kentucky, and Pennsylvania. And Irina Zhurov reports there is a new push to clean up this scarred land.
In central Pennsylvania coal country, traces of the old industry are easy to see. People here landscape their lawns with shiny chunks of anthracite coal, and school mascots have names like the Battle and Miners. In tiny Shamokin, I meet Mitch Troutman in the parking lot of a grocery store. Mitch grew up here, and he's an old friend of mine, so he's taking me on a tour.
Where are we going?
The Strippins.
What is that?
That's, a whole lot of abandoned coal lands, abandoned from deep mines and strip mines, and they've just been kind of left there.
Mitch turns off the road into an abandoned strip mine. Its owner deserted it a long time ago, when the company finished mining it. It wasn't until 1977 that Congress started requiring companies to properly clean up when a mine closed down. We bump along on boulders and through mud holes.
I mean, this is pretty much exactly why I have a truck.
The Strippins are kind of an unpatrolled playground, so if a bad breakdown happens, Mitch says people call their friends. If they can't help, the next call is to the one bar in town in hopes that someone with a big truck is there. But a flat tire? He can handle that.
It's all right, I have what I need. Be a couple minutes.
He starts jacking the car up. Mitch is an amateur historian and is working on a book about local coal. All day, we've been talking about how coal in this area helped drive industrialization and dominated community life here.
But then, starting in the Great Depression, the coal market kind of collapsed, and we still haven't recovered from the Great Depression, I guess you could say.
This is a national problem, but Pennsylvania has more abandoned mine lands than any other state.
You just have a century or more of like mines on top of mines on top of mines to the point where you can't look around and even imagine what was there before.
I noticed the ground beneath us is a mixture of coal, broken glass, and tire shreds.
Okay, can you do me a favor with the jack?
Mm-hmm.
Pull the handle out. Awesome, thank you. Ooh, there's even hair in this tire.
Tire changed, we get back on the road for just a second before dropping down again onto a black path cutting through young woods.
Coal Hill's like right here. We just gotta pass around this little hump. Hey, didn't bottom out.
We drive up to Coal Hill and it is striking. The tall, bare, black mountain completely dominates the landscape.
The biggest pile of coal you've ever seen. You know, I have trouble describing it because it's hard to describe, I think.
See, those parts right there kind of almost look like sand dunes. Yeah. And it's got like all the formations of a real geological mountain or mound, but it's just all made out of coal.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, from being stacked in whatever order it was stacked and then being sitting out here for, I don't know, a century or something.
Adults and kids on dirt bikes are riding up and down Coal Hill attempting tricks. Others are picnicking. They're using this forsaken pile of coal refuse just like they might some beautiful public lands. Lest all this gallivanting around on Terra Incognita sounds like a whole lot of fun to you, I want to make it clear that abandoned mine lands can actually be quite dangerous. People die on these old mine sites because of unstable land.
You've got mine subsidence where holes are opening up in the ground in many locations.
That's Robert Hughes with the Eastern Pennsylvania Coalition for Abandoned Mine Reclamation. These aren't necessarily toxic Superfund sites, but mine fires can burn for years in some places, gases from mines can make air unsafe, soils and dust can hold contamination, ecosystems are disrupted.
And then last but not least is the 5,500 and some odd miles of streams that are polluted by abandoned mines.
The law that now requires companies to clean up after themselves also established a fund to clean up the old abandoned mines. And states like Pennsylvania have been cleaning up for decades now. They've backfilled holes left by taking out coal, installed water filtration systems, and planted trees and grass on repaired soils. Still, it would take $10 billion more to clean up abandoned coal mines nationally. With coal communities struggling, there have been calls to do more faster. A bill in front of Congress proposes distributing $1 billion in cleanup money to states on a quicker timetable.
We're tired of waiting for something to come here and nothing ever comes in our region that is getting us away from coal. And if we can't remove some of this stuff from the landscape, I'm not sure what we're going to attract here.
The goal isn't just to clean up abandoned coal mines, but also to return that land to productive uses so communities can start to plan for a new future. To see what that might look like, I headed over to the Anthracite Outdoor Adventure Area nearby. Started primarily with local funds, it's like a formalized, cleaned-up version of the Strippin's Playground. Dave Borsey, Director of Operations, says here, people wear helmets.
Let's see if a large will fit you. There we go, that'll work.
He shows me around on an off-road vehicle.
Let's go.
Dave calls himself a veteran trespasser on the land. He used to come hang out here when it was abandoned. Now, the trash is gone, holes from the mining operations are filled in, and people pay to ride the trails. They bring ATVs, dirt bikes, go-karts. Dave admires a passing Jeep.
Very nice CJ5, man. Very, very nice. Enjoying yourselves? Awesome, awesome. Thanks for coming out. See ya.
He says people come from all over to ride these trails, and as their numbers grow, they'll need restaurants, gas stations, hotels, which spells jobs, at least in theory. Dave sees recreation as the new coal around these parts. He says you can't do much else on this mined out land.
I have 3 water softeners. Just to use the water, you gotta wash your hands and flush the toilet. It's not potable. So ultimately, this is outdoor recreation, really, is what this property is meant for.
There are other ideas for what this abandoned land could be. Business parks, a botanic garden, new roads. In the past year, Congress has doled out millions of dollars to coal states as a pilot to see if prioritizing economic development during cleanup can help revitalize coal towns. Perhaps the money can go further if it goes not just to the dirtiest sites, but ones that have potential to create jobs and local revenues. My friend Mitch Troutman isn't crazy about the off-roading facility or paying to ride when he's got free access to the Strippin's in his backyard. but he doesn't quite know what to do with all this battered land.
It's like part of who everybody is out here. I don't want to see it turned into like a parking lot with like a couple of McDonald's and stuff in there, you know? It's hard to have an answer for that.
Irina Zhurov reported this story. We're talking about what happens when we abandon things or spaces and what comes in to take over, from the deep countryside to the inner city. Many big cities experienced massive population declines after the 1950s. Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, Philadelphia. And as people moved out, houses became abandoned. So you see city blocks with lots of empty buildings, no windows, no doors, fallen down walls. And these empty buildings can cause many problems and also public health issues. This is something ER Dr. Gina South started noticing at work.
One of the things I do in the emergency department is treat people who come in after overdoses. And very frequently people tell me that they do use abandoned houses as a place to do drugs. And I think in part that's because they're spaces that can be very easy to get into, but are somewhat private.
We're in the process now of actually acquiring the rest of the abandoned houses that's on this block as well.
Mel Wells sees this kind of thing all of the time. I met up with him in North Philadelphia, and he told me that people have the wrong idea about what looks like empty buildings.
That they just abandoned homes and nobody's in them. No, some of these homes people are living in. And then what also happens is the houses become infested with drug and alcohol use, prostitution. My name is Mel Wells, president of One Day at a Time, Drug and Alcohol, HIV and AIDS Shelter Organization.
And Fixer Upper.
And fix up and do whatever I got to do to serve my community.
Right. Mel started fixing up abandoned houses with his dad when he was a kid. We step inside a dilapidated row home. The paint is peeling off the walls. It smells like mildew.
No lights, trash everywhere. Things like needles. You get to see crack vials. You get to see loose condoms and so forth. A lot of different things happen in these homes. You find dead bodies. You find prostitution going on. You contract HIV and AIDS, hepatitis C.
And these empty homes can impact rates of violence, says ER Dr. Gina South.
As you increase the number of abandoned houses in a neighborhood, you increase the chance of aggravated assault.
They also make people feel unsafe and stressed out, which has an effect on mental health.
So people were very fearful of walking past these spaces, which when you have to walk past a space like that day in and day out, and you're afraid even on your own block or in your own neighborhood, that can have an impact on your health.
And this is something Mel Wells remembers from his own childhood, and he still hears about it a lot.
The mindset of a kid who's walking past a block where he see that two homes are filled on a block that has 40 homes, it's a mindset that makes him be abandoned almost in the mind.
Mel and his organization, One Day at a Time, buy up abandoned houses, and then they hire members of the community, some who used to be homeless, to fix them up and turn them into homeless shelters.
Can we go in there?
He takes me to another house, a couple doors down from the abandoned property we just visited.
Okay, so this is a work in progress?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
This one is painted bright orange, it has new windows, a new door, the rehabbing is almost done.
This is what we want to do with next door. You come in here, you see the lights on. By tomorrow, you will have 14 women who live on the street that will be living in this living arrangement. And hopefully in 6 months to a year, that they'll be moving out to their own apartments. So, you know, like you recycle trash, we could recycle abandoned houses as well.
Mel Wells is the president of One Day at a Time in Philadelphia. We're exploring what happens when we abandon spaces and things and people. About a year ago, Paige Flager met a family celebrating a major milestone. They were reunited after nearly 50 years apart.
Keith Murphy still remembers the day he found out he had a brother he had never met.
Sitting at a kitchen table one day when I was almost around 16, my dad came in the door drunk. And he just went off on this wild tirade. And he proceeded to put his finger on my mother's face and said, why don't you tell him about Greg, is what he called him. And that was the very first time I found out that I actually had a brother.
Keith collected clues from his father's drunken episodes. Eventually, he pieced together the story behind his long-lost younger brother, a story that began on the day that Keith was born in 1964. Here's his mom, Nancy Oakes DeWitt.
Well, I was a 16-year-old unwed mother. Living at home with my parents, madly in love with his father. Neither one of us old enough to get married, and if we could get married, and how would we support each other? And so I had Keith. I brought him home and raised him with my parents' help.
How did your parents react to that?
To Keith? Mm-hmm. Well, they were furious when I told him I was pregnant, but they loved him. I mean, and they helped raise him, and they were wonderful to him.
They were kind to him, but told Nancy that if she got pregnant again, they would take Keith away from her and send her to girls' reformatory school. And a few years later, she got pregnant again. She was scared, so she hid it for 9 months. The night of September 18th, 1966, Nancy went into labor in the backseat of her car. Her boyfriend, Patrick, who was just 17 at the time, delivered the baby himself. It was a boy. He cut the umbilical cord and tied it off with a shoelace. He then wrapped the baby in white towels and left him in a random car parked outside of a New Jersey bowling alley.
I've given away my baby. And it's a place I don't want to ever have to go through again. It doesn't get any easier with the heart.
Nancy didn't look at or hold the baby. She never told anyone. She and Patrick got married soon after and had two daughters and another son. While his family was crumbling, Keith embarked on a search. He looked for police reports, adoption records, news articles, anything that might lead him to the brother that his parents had given up. But after decades of dead ends, Keith lost hope. Then, about a year ago, he got a strange notification from Ancestry.com. He had taken a DNA test in order to sort out his ethnicity and put together his family tree.
The results came in, and you look at the ethnicity at the top, and I'm like, okay, 65% British. You scroll down to your direct connections. And lo and behold, I found Scott Winter 17 as a direct either sibling or grandparent. And just knowing that all my grandparents had passed away, it just basically meant that he was a direct sibling.
He found Scott on Facebook and sent him a message. And when that message hit Scott's inbox in California, he couldn't believe his eyes.
And I remember standing, looking at my computer in disbelief for probably like 10 minutes going, you know, is this a trick? Is somebody playing with me? And then it took me about another 5 or 10 minutes to actually dial his number. I remember standing there, my hand was shaking.
I still remember the very first phone call. I answered the phone, he goes, Keith. I go, yes. He goes, this is Scott. And I said, oh man, I was waiting for this phone call for all my life.
Keith and Scott discovered that they have a lot of similarities. They're both in sales, grew up in the same part of New Jersey, and share an obsession for shoes and peanut butter. Scott had a happy life, but one of the most difficult parts of his childhood was all of the questions that he had when he found out he was adopted.
You know, do I have siblings, and what are they like? And, you know, with relation to your biological mother, I always wondered, you know, on key dates, you know, like birthday, Christmas, stuff like that, you know, is she out there thinking about me? Or, you know, just, you know, on one hand, you're kind of cast aside, so you always wonder, okay, am I at least in their thoughts?
His birthday, Christmas, the first few years when you saw a little one running around that would have been his age, you always wondered, I wonder if that's mine. And yes, it was very painful. Mm-hmm.
Almost 49 years after Scott was abandoned, he got to know his biological family. His mom, Nancy, his siblings, Keith, Lene, Charles, and Jeanette. They had a big holiday celebration.
You know, we had Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas yesterday. Our first one together.
So. All three in one day.
Yeah.
What does that look like?
It was a mess.
Look at the back. Oh, yeah. Well, the back.
I had Christmas now, in one section. Yeah. We had a Thanksgiving dinner. We had Halloween in another section. But, you know, it's like trying to make up for lost time. That can never happen.
Well, and you guys squeezed in 49 birthdays on me when I was.
Yeah.
When we first met, they came out. They came out with a birthday cake with all these candles on it. And they start singing happy birthday, and I'm looking around going, whose birthday is it? And because it wasn't even close to my birthday. And I don't know what I was thinking. I went out and I bought a lottery ticket after all of this happened. And obviously I didn't win. Otherwise we'd be having this interview down in Jamaica or something. But I'm like, what am I thinking? I already hit the lottery.
They talked like this for a while, huddled together on a couch. This was only the second time that they had all been together, but they didn't look like strangers. They looked like family. For The Pulse, I'm Paige Flager.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about abandonment on the show today, including letting go of things we love and care about. Belinda Pastrana is a biophysical chemistry professor at the University of Puerto Rico at Mayagüez. She's been there for 20 years, but the post-hurricane realities of life are forcing her to abandon everything she's worked for. As Hurricane Maria pounded the island in September with sustained winds of 155 miles per hour, homes were destroyed, trees uprooted, Belinda hunkered down in her house, hoping for the best.
It is very difficult to be able to withstand that emotionally and also just thinking about your families and your loved ones.
The storm knocked out power to the entire island. Belinda says in her community and at the university, everybody was as prepared as they could be, with lots of extra water and power generators.
But waking up that following day and you're used to using cell phones, you're used to using electricity, you're used to using water from your faucet, and all of a sudden, all of that is gone. You're back to your great-grandparents' time, and no economy can withstand that, not today.
Belinda was on the west coast of the island, and she says most of the buildings in her region stayed intact, but long lines started to form everywhere for food, water, gas to power generators, money at the bank. Belinda researches proteins that are used in medications for illnesses like Parkinson's or cancer. She also owns a science startup company. When she was finally able to check on her labs, she found devastation.
So we lost all reagents that had to be refrigerated or frozen, $250,000 worth of reagents that were very unique because they were designed and built in and made in our lab.
How many hours, days, years of work was that?
20 years. We had a 14,000-gallon reserve of diesel fuel with a power generator. We had solar panels, and we also had a battery backup system, and all systems failed.
After the storm, Belinda came to Nevada for a science conference, and since then, she's been traveling on the East Coast, looking for a new home for herself, her company, and some of her students.
I'm trying to help my students relocate to the U.S., different campuses. The great thing about being a scientist is that there's tremendous community, and they all understand. And you cultivate that through so many years of interaction, going to these scientific presentations. That's where we meet. In terms of our startup, my co-founder is right now in New York, and I am here in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and we're trying to look for a temporary site.
Can you replicate all the things you've lost? How long will that take you?
Years. Years.
Do you feel like you are forced to sort of abandon this community that you had for 20 years, where you've built a life?
you have to keep focused on what is the bigger picture, and what we are developing can help patients around the world several times. So that is my focus right now, and I'm very passionate towards that.
But it must hurt.
It does.
Yeah.
20 years worth.
Belinda Pastrana is a professor of biophysical chemistry at the University of Puerto Rico. When there is a hurricane looming, emergency planners try to get the word out, urging people to prepare and to evacuate.
Do not sit and wait to prepare. Get prepared now.
When Hurricane Irma was threatening Florida in September, many people who had cars or could afford a plane ticket got out and as far away as possible. For other people who needed a safe place to go, Miami-Dade County opened more than 40 shelters. Reporter Kate Stein was on assignment during Irma, and she spent 3 nights at a shelter covering what was happening. About 500 evacuees eventually made their way to this place at Miami Edison Senior High School.
It's Saturday morning, the day before forecasters say the worst of Irma is going to hit Florida. Breakfast, a scoop of eggs, a biscuit, and a juice pouch, has just ended in the cafeteria. Gloria Gitti and her 2 adult children are sitting at one of the tables. The Gitti stopped at 5 different shelters before ending up here. Some sites had lines of people waiting outside before volunteers even arrived to let them in. If one shelter was full, people were directed to another one nearby. Gloria is 76. She's taking care of Nelly and Jose. They both have cerebral palsy. They can't walk well, she says, and it affects their minds a little, too. Jose is 32 and uses a wheelchair. Nelly is 38 and relies on a walker.
Say hi, Mommy. Jose Giri. Say hi.
As her mom talks, Nelly quietly draws shaky shapes that look sort of like letters. Gloria says Edison is a better shelter than some of the others they saw. Staff put the family next to the women's bathroom, so it's easier for her to take Jose and Nelly there. Jose's sleeping on the air mattress they brought. Gloria and Nelly sleep sitting up, and that's sort of good because the red tile floor is cold and hard.
Unbelievable.
Sitting at the front desk is unofficial volunteer Anthony Whitfield. He doesn't understand, I don't understand, the lack of first aid, why there aren't blankets or cots, at least for the elderly people here. Turns out, general population hurricane shelters don't provide cots, and there are no nurses or health aides here. Edison wasn't supposed to be sheltering medically vulnerable people.
I just can't stand it when a senior citizen got to sleep on a hard floor. So this is bad times for a lot of people, where they just can't take no more.
One evacuee attempted suicide by taking pills. Workers called an ambulance to come care for him, but...
Fire and rescue said that we cannot transport him. We wanted to transport him straight to the hospital. But we can't have they can't have any cars on the streets.
Rescue workers are watching over the man in the principal's office. There's a mix of middle-income and homeless people here. People with mental health problems. A guy who says he was in prison for 13 years. He tells me he got out 5 days ago and took a bus to Miami because he'd never seen the ocean. Entrepreneurial types sneak out of the shelter to a corner store and come back with cigarettes and cold beers. There are also families with small kids. There are police officers, National Guardsmen, and county employees, kitchen and custodial staff. They're all trying to be patient, but like everyone, they're getting frustrated and bored. I make a homeless evacuee a peanut butter sandwich from what's left in my duffel bag and share granola bars with a man who was bussed over from the airport. He didn't have a chance to stock up on supplies. They both say official storm prep left them behind.
I need you to help us sing. Okay.
At the front desk, Anthony Whitfield's trying to keep spirits up.
We make the best that we can. It will be over this in another 2 days.
He's with a bunch of older women and a few men, several from nearby Little Haiti. Anthony leads them in a song he says he just made up.
God's been good, he's been good, he's been good. Now sing it in French.
For people with medical conditions, the county has special shelters and a registry where you're supposed to sign up well before a hurricane hits. But when I asked around, a lot of people who could have used that help said they didn't know about it. Basic information, like what to bring with you and how you get it there without a car, and when it might be safe to leave, and whether anyone can help you get ice or food or power when you finally get home. Many people never got that information. For The Pulse, I'm Kate Stein.
Miami-Dade County is examining its shelter procedures as part of a larger review of what worked and what didn't during Hurricane Irma. We're talking about what happens when we abandon things and what comes in to take over. In the animal kingdom, abandonment is fairly common. Biologist Karen Bonder says animals often leave their babies behind for hours.
It's also incredibly common for certain animal mothers to abandon their newborns for weeks to months at a time.
Karen has a new book coming out. It's called Wild Moms, and it's all about the journey of motherhood in the animal world. And I asked her to tell me about animals that abandon their young for good.
I guess for a lot of animals, what we would consider to be abandoning is part of their process. So I would like to maybe draw on an example from the marine world where we see things that are the large seals. So these are called phocid seals, and they put on a great deal of body weight before giving birth. So they'll haul themselves out onto the sea ice and give birth and then lactate exclusively for a period of, 3 to 4 weeks. And then when that period of lactation is done, they slip back into the water, never to see their babies again. The babies are then forced to, with the task of making their way to the world. They've put on a significant amount of weight since they were born, and that's part of the social system in these animals is, okay, literally sink or swim, I'm out, because mom's got other stuff to do. She's got to carry on to get the next generation going.
What's the sort of harshest abandonment story that you've come across in your research?
When new primate mothers are not ready, they will often treat their babies almost like little dolls. And it's interesting and humbling to know that primate mothers are among many animals and humans included that don't get it right the first time. It takes practice. It takes learning. We're not built with the machinery in us that makes us perfect mothers right away. You need to learn. And a lot of times in the animal kingdom, many first-time moms are barely past puberty themselves, and yet there they are having offspring while their own bodies are still needing to grow and mature. And in these instances, we do sort of see mistreatment of babies and abandonment just for the simple reason they don't really get it yet. That's tough.
So how does that manifest?
So it will often manifest in just plain and simple the death of the baby. In some close-knit societies where there are a lot of maternal relatives around, many primates live in groups where there's multiple females that birth babies at a similar time. Close relatives, or even in some cases not biological relatives, but close friends, will be around to pick up where mom has left off. But, of course, that's the best-case scenario, and then the worst-case scenario is that nobody's got time or energy, and then the babies simply don't make it.
Last time I spoke with Karen, it was about her book Wild Sex, and she told me a pretty savage story about a praying mantis getting his head chewed off during intercourse. And she topped that story this time by telling me about the Nazca booby, a tropical bird that lives in the Galapagos.
In years of poor resource availability, both mama and dad have to be away from the nest for extremely long periods of time to find food for their babies. A lot of seabirds live on these, islands that are literally pop-up rock islands in the middle of the ocean, and there isn't food anywhere nearby. So in Nazca boobies in particular, though, when mom and dad have abandoned their chick to do this, they get visits from it's quite perplexing to biologists. They're called non-parental adult visitors, like kind of pedophiles, if you will. And there are other Nazca boobies that are just not paired or, you know, rogue. Scientists don't really understand. So these adult visitors come to the chicks and either sexually abuse them, or they'll actually peck holes in their necks to sort of wound them. They don't kill them this way, but they then abandon those chicks who are then attacked by blood-sucking parasitic birds.
Ooh.
That come along because they're attracted to the scent of their blood. So it's this horrible story of abandonment, really, because mom and dad have had to abandon, and then along comes this horrible predator thing that abuses and then abandons as well.
Wow. So we ended our last interview by me saying how happy I was to be a human, and I guess I feel that way again now. So
right?
Wow. I hope I won't get in trouble for all that. Karen Bondar is a biologist. Her new book is Wild Moms. It wasn't that long ago that everything we heard on the radio, through speakers, through headphones, was recorded, edited, and played on tape. Reel to reel. It was a mainstay for us in public radio, that's for sure, and it captured the soundtracks of the 20th and even 21st century. These days, sound recording is totally different. The technology of tape has pretty much been abandoned, but this vintage approach to audio is not totally dead. Alana Gordon has this story.
It was around 2006, and Danny Miller was in a panic.
Ampex, which was the main tape manufacturer, stopped making tape.
No tape being manufactured meant no recording or editing in the way he and his team had relied on for decades. It was at the core of the production magic behind a radio show you might have heard of.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Danny is the longtime executive producer of Fresh Air here at WHYY. And for years, the national show used reels of tape to record, edit, and playback shows. They'd mastered a system, part science, part craft.
It's a little dusty, astuter.
Yeah.
Danny shows me an old reel-to-reel machine hiding in the corner of their studio. Imagine a really big cassette tape, flat on a table with two big spools.
Yeah.
Audrey Bentham, Fresh Air's chief engineer, cues up an old reel.
Just the sounds the machine makes and the sounds of the pinch roller hitting the sound. It's just like the sounds of production for the past 20 years, just relics of what it used to be like.
We only have about a minute left, and then our time is going to be up because they need the
Danny says up. Editing so an interview recorded on tape, meaning taking out part of the conversation or smoothing out a mistake, was all about using your ears to mark the changes and guide your hands.
You would basically listen, and when you got to an edit point, you would take a little wax marker, make a little white mark.
Then you'd literally cut or splice the tape with a razor blade at a 45-degree angle, take out what you didn't want, and glue it back together. That may seem really cumbersome these days, but reel-to-reel completely transformed how audio was produced.
It opened up all kinds of possibilities for editing.
Susan Schmidt-Horning is a professor at St. John's University and author of Chasing Sound, a book that's all about the history of recording technology. She says the concept of tape dates back to the late 1800s. But magnetic tape and the reel-to-reel process as we know it really took off after World War II.
It was based on a German recorder, the Magnetophon, which was used by Hitler.
Towards the end of the war, U.S. servicemen brought it home. And then, Susan says, this guy caught wind of it.
The Bing Crosby Show.
Bing Crosby wanted an easier way to record and edit his radio show. He got excited about the technological possibilities of this new machine. So he fronted the money for a manufacturer, Ampex, to make one. And with that, the reel-to-reel tape recorder of the 20th century was basically born.
And then he'd roll, roll, roll. Way up the river he would roll.
By the 60s, machines could record multiple tape tracks of separate voices or instruments. The sound quality got better and moved into stereo. But then, you probably know where this is going.
Digital recording replaced tape for many people.
Enter the digital age, totally revolutionizing the industry. No tapes needed, just computer software.
Well, digital came in a couple of different ways.
Jim Anderson is an audio engineer who went through the transition. He teaches at NYU. He's recorded and mixed classical, rock, and jazz artists, and some NPR shows. Jim says the shift to digital began as people got frustrated with some of the limitations of tape, like the distortion sounds from the recording and playback process. Digital didn't really have this issue.
It was a different sound, I think, is what people responded to. The bass would have been clearer, and maybe the top end had a little more transient to it.
Early digital programs surfaced in the late 1970s. They were clunky at first, and the lack of a physical thing to edit and record on was a hard switch. But the reliability and quality of digital improved over the following decades.
It went from being a toy to being ubiquitous.
Digital had a lot of advantages. You could add even more tracks for recording, and editing was a whole new world. It's like a Word document for audio. You can so easily undo and redo, undo and redo. And you could easily edit and shape sounds that would be super complicated, if not impossible, with a razor blade.
Especially in our orchestral work, we can do things that we could never do. The dynamic range that we have available to us.
And digital didn't just make recording easier, it made it more portable. Like this summer, Jim got a call to record Gonzalo Rubalcaba, a jazz pianist. A few weeks later, he was making a major recording.
We went to Cuba and did a recording there in August, and we took with us a laptop, a front end, and some microphones, and it all sat on the size of a card table. You know, and if we had done that in the past, like the guys from Mercury Living Presence in the 50s, they flew a truck to Russia. It's just crazy.
Digital has also democratized the process. People can produce sonic wonders in their basement. But if you think tape has been totally abandoned, think again. Reel to Reel still holds a special place among audio nerds and studio producers.
The War on Drugs, Lost in the Dream record was recorded a lot here at this studio. A lot of that process would be, you know, recording to this 2-inch tape machine.
Brian McTeer is a record producer and owns Minor Street Recordings in Philadelphia, where he's worked on albums for the likes of War on Drugs, Kurt Weill, Hopalong, and Joan Osborne. He stands over his Ampex tape machine, and yes, he records on it all the time.
Recording studios still use tape. They do. And for a lot of reasons. Here, let me show you the tape machine. Let me show you this.
Brian's tape machine is like 300 pounds. It's the size of an industrial washer, and it can record up to 24 tracks. For him, the power of this machine is far more than the type of sound that it records. Recording on tape enforces a musical process. Band members must play together, recording all at once, instead of editing and manipulating sound so perfectly that they're perfectly boring. McTeer says a song, especially in rock and roll, is not just the sum of its parts. The music comes in the way it's played together.
Tape sort of reinforces the necessity of something we're all very used to and something that's very sort of central to what music is, and that is ensemble performance.
Now, Brian also uses digital for editing and recording a lot, but he starts bands off on tape. He uses tape machines for something else too. Creating a specific sound. We'll even play a digital file through it to produce certain effects.
Like a flange effect would be like there's a drum fill in the middle of Tears for Fears, Head Over Heels, right? Everything stops and drums go do, 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 do. Sounds like time and space being like peeled apart. That's a flange effect that you can do with a tape machine. It's really fun.
Do you think that in 5 years you'll still be using this thing, or maybe you'll make the switch over to digital?
So I will definitely be using this tape machine for the rest of my life. And if nobody wants it after I'm dead, they should bury me with it.
That's your ender.
That's your ender.
Back inside the Fresh Air studio, Audrey Bentham, the show's chief engineer, fast forwards to the end of the tape reel till it hits the edges as it circles around and around.
It's a classic sound of a tape machine spooling off.
Fresh Air's use of tape spooled off in 2007. Again, executive producer Danny Miller.
We were actually pretty late to digital editing.
Even so, Danny says the language of reel-to-reel is still everywhere in the vocabulary and mindset of the show.
We still refer to everything we do digitally as tape. We talk about, did you get good tape? That was really boring tape.
But once they switched over to digital, they haven't looked back.
Digital is just so much more convenient.
I mean, it's just so easy.
Do you miss cutting tape?
I kind of miss the showing off of the craft. But no. I don't miss cutting tape.
Alana Gordon reported this story, and one of the audio engineers she interviewed, Jim Anderson, shared something that he mixed on tape many moons ago. It's a vintage All Things Considered promo.
Consider all the things All Things Considered considers.
Like what?
Why would you keep everybody in school until...
That's our show for this week. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, and Alan Yu are our health and science reporters. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager and Alex Stern are our associate producers. Tanya English is our managing editor. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care. Supporting The Pulse, Penn Neurosciences. At Penn Neurosciences, brain and spine specialists work together to help people break through the darkness of their disease, from delivering clinical research to finding new approaches to treat MS and epilepsy, to developing advanced procedures for brain and spine disorders. The Penn Neurosciences team cares for each patient and their individual needs. More information is available at pennmedicine.org/neuro.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.